All right, so let's get started. One announcement that I have, obviously, the first assignment is due on Saturday. We signed it in. And every once in a while, we get questions to the staff list, like one or two per day, so we try to send them to the news group. Because it just reduces the amount of traffic on our staff list, and like, it makes the communication more valuable for everyone else that has the same problem. All right, so let's talk a bit, just some basic stuff. Maybe for the first few lectures about delay. We talked about it as latency in the first couple lectures. So suppose we have two hosts, A and B, and A wants to send an L-bit message to B over a link, just a single link, no router in between, of length D, and the link has a transfer rate of R bits per second. So the question is, what are the relevant delays in this equation, in this transfer, or the latency between A and B? And so the two types of delay in this transfer are propagation delay and transmission delay. And we went over it slightly. It was like one line in the lecture notes under latency. So I thought we would take a quicker look, or take a more in-depth look of what those delays mean. So anyone has any questions about the setup of the problem? All right, so first let's talk about propagation delay. So propagation delay is just the physical amount of time that it takes to send one bit from A to B. So, and this is bounded by the length of the actual cable plus the speed of light, because we're sending electromagnetic wave, whether that's optical signal or electrical signal. It's electromagnetic waves bounded by some fraction of the speed of light, usually around 2 × 10⁸ meters per second. So our propagation delay of sending just a single bit from A to B is the distance from A to B in terms of cable length over the propagation speed, S. So it doesn't matter how wide the length between A and B is. In other words, the bandwidth between A and B doesn't matter. The minimum time it takes for anything to get from A to B is this propagation delay. Does that make sense? And that's bounded by the speed of light. There's nothing you can do about it, as far as we know. So that's one of the delays involved. Any questions? All right, the other delay in this equation, or in this transfer, is the transmission delay. And that's the time it takes to push all the bits of the message, of the L bits of the message, onto the link. And that's governed by the throughput of R of the link in bits per second, and the length of the message L. So you have L bits, and you have a link that's 100 megabits per second, and it takes L over 100 megabits per second to push the entire message onto the link. Then it takes another propagation delay for that whole message to travel across the link from A to B. So here's some example transmission rates. If you have a fully utilized fast Ethernet link that's 100 megabits per second, ADSL, it varies, but common one is 1.5 megabits per second. It depends on what you sign up for at the provider.
This is a small data, but if you say bits, shouldn't the B be like a small letter instead of a typo?
Yeah. That was a typo. Fix that.
Let's fix it. So commonly,
there's one more quick note. So in networking, we usually talk about bits per second, so BPS, and megabits per second. So you probably remember in CS106 or some of these other intermediate classes, you find a mega is 2 to the 20th. So in terms like a megabyte is 2 to the 20th bytes. But in networking, when we talk about a megabit, it's usually 1 × 10⁶. So megabits per second, that's equal to 1 × 10⁶ bits per second. So if you actually compute this out, 1 × 10⁶ is slightly less than 2 to the 20th. Because 2 to the 20th is the same as 2 to the 10th squared, which is the same as 1,024 squared, is obviously equal to 1,000 squared. So you'll often end up with these slight inconsistencies when you use these calculations. Do the storage guys want to talk about mega in terms of power to 2? And the networking guys want to talk about mega in terms of 1 times 10 to the 6th. So just a quick note. Any questions on this? All right, so the total delay, like I said, is the propagation delay plus the transmission delay. And so that's D over S plus L over R. So suppose, let's plug in some numbers. D is a kilometer, S is 2 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. So we're propagating at 2/3 the speed of light over this cable, whether it's Ethernet or optical fiber or whatever it is. That takes 5 microseconds. The length of the message is 500 bytes, so 4,000 bits. And over 100 megabits per second, that's 40 microseconds. So it takes the total latency between A and B for the transfer at 45 microseconds. Does this part make sense? Any questions? So what happens when we compose links and put routers in between is the question. So this is a simple point-to-point transfer between A and B. They're connected by one cable. Of course, the internet doesn't work like that. We have host A and host B, and we might have some routers in between. And there might be other flows coming in. So maybe this first router has 3 links coming in, the second router might have some other links coming in, the third router might have some other links coming in. So the actual latency along this path from A to B varies with the amount of queuing delay in each router. So when we compose the links into multiple hops, when we put routers in between, we have to add a queuing delay component. The book talks about this slightly in section 1.6. So we'll get into this later in the class. But since the queuing delay at each router depends on the flow inflow of packets from other links in the network, it's generally a bit hard to quantify unless you want to use some mathematical model, like some sort of arrival process to model the queue. But that's the general idea. So if you compose links, it's not just the propagation and transmission delay along each of these links. It's also the queuing delay at each of these routers. So at each of these routers, you have to add that queuing delay, which is some complex function of what the inflow into that router is. So that's just the general idea. We'll get into it later in the class. So hopefully, that one line in the first two lecture notes where it says latency is queuing delay plus propagation delay plus transmission delay, that's what that line actually means. Does anyone have any questions?
Yeah. So this all starts from like the moment where the original host actually pushes.
Right.
Because like, wouldn't there be time associated with like that hardware's like,
yeah, so there's some processing delay involved as well, but it's usually negligible, so we just add it. So you can add that into processing delay at each node. So if you have like a 1 hertz processor or something like that, like a really fast one, I guess it could be like kind of important, but it doesn't really matter in this case. You're right, like take some time to DMA the packet onto the network card and stuff like this, but compared to like, right, this stuff is usually on the order of milliseconds or something for like a long transfer. So, by the way, you should check my math at some point, just because I just did this right now. I might have been off by an alpha or something.
What about
relation to
the Ethernet?
About what? Collisions? Yeah, collision we'll get into later when we talk about link layer. This is just assuming point-to-point link, so there's no collision.
Right.
And in fact, most networks today are point-to-point. Most everything computers move from point to point now, so you don't have to worry about collisions. So his question is, what happens if I had multiple guys sharing the same wire? And you can imagine if A and B are trying to send something at the same time over this shared wire, A and B will be in conflict because they'll both be trying to talk at the same time. And that doesn't happen here because we only have one wire between A and B.
But
but in any case, we're going to go over this when we talk about link layer stuff, so you don't have to worry about it yet. And this is just point-to-point link, and not wireless. Any other questions? All right, let's talk quickly about bisection bandwidth. So take any network topology, and this is what we talked about on Thursday quickly. So we take a network topology, we slice it in half. If it's an odd size network, then it's obviously one side will have one more node than the other side. One side of the partition has one more node than the other side of the partition. And if we take the bandwidth of all the links that cross that partition, that's the bisection bandwidth. And if we take all possible sets of partitions and find the worst possible bandwidth between all sets of partitions, then that's the worst case bisection. And usually people, when they say bisection bandwidth, they're usually referring to the worst case bisection bandwidth, as we talked about in the lecture. So for example, in this case, the worst case bisection bandwidth, assume the black ones are 10 megabits per second, the green ones 100 megabits per second, the red ones 1 gigabit per second. Now that I'm looking at this, so this is right. There's four. We partition the nodes into four and four, so the red box is four nodes, and the other nodes that aren't in the red box are the other four nodes. And so we have these four black links that cross this red box. That's a total bisection bandwidth of 40 megabits per second. And I think that's the worst case bisection bandwidth for this graph. That makes sense? All right, so on Tuesday we talked a bit about peer-to-peer versus client-to-server file transfer. And we went into a bit of the specifics of BitTorrent and Skype and all these other peer-to-peer protocols. But here I'm just going to go over an example that's just perfectly ideal to give you an idea of what the advantages of peer-to-peer file transfer are. So suppose we have client-server, a simple client-server topology. So everyone's getting their file from the server, all the clients are the guys that want the file. So suppose Blizzard wants to distribute a patch for World of Warcraft, and they have 5 million players, and they want to distribute these 450 megabyte patches over 5 hours. So how many 100 megabits per second servers are needed? For a simple arithmetic, 3600 megabits, right, that's 450 megabytes times 5 million over 5 hours. All the numbers are chosen so that you're not doing math. So that's 1 × 10^12 bits per second. That's the aggregate bandwidth you need. And if each server has 100 megabits per second of bandwidth, then you need 10,000 servers. So what do you think? Do you think Blizzard has 10,000 servers distributing patches for World of Warcraft? Probably not. So they use another strategy. So does this arithmetic make sense to everybody? All right, so let's take a look at the peer-to-peer model. So instead of 10,000 servers, let's use 100 megabits per second server. Suppose each client has a 1 megabit per second full duplex length, which is kind of optimistic, true, because a lot of links aren't full duplex. In other words, the send and receive rate aren't equal at 1 megabits per second, but just for this problem, just assume it's like that. And all these peer-to-peer protocols, like BitTorrent that we talked about in class on Tuesday, they generally split the file into chunks. So assume we split the patch into 450 chunks of 1 megabyte each. And then suppose we use this peer-to-peer protocol. So I'm going to seed each chunk to one client each. So there's 450 chunks. I'm going to send one chunk to some client that connects. So there's going to be 450 clients. Each of them are going to have one of those 450 chunks of the patch. I'm going to wait for every client to get at least one chunk from those seed clients. And then once everybody has at least one chunk, then I'm going to wait for every client to acquire the other 449 chunks. So by this stage, everyone has a chunk, and we can use the total aggregate bandwidth of the whole network. So we'll go over it in a little more detail. So first we'll see we have one server instead of 10,000 this time. It has 100 megabits per second of bandwidth. How long does it take to seed each chunk to one client each? Well, there's 450 chunks for 1 megabyte each. The aggregate bandwidth at the server is 100 megabits per second, so it takes a minute to seed. You'll have to run the numbers yourself to make sure I didn't lie to you. But it takes a minute to transfer 450 megabytes across 100 megabits per second. So that's the simple step. So now we have 450 clients that have one chunk each, right? By the way, are there any questions so far? All right, so there's 450 clients. Each of them has one chunk each right now. And now I'm going to wait for every client, all the other 5 million clients, to get a chunk each. So let's just take a look at one of the chunks, because the distribution is going to happen in parallel, right? Because we're just requiring each client to get one chunk. So we have 5 million clients and 450 seeds, so we're going to have 11,000 about clients per seed. And this distribution takes place exponentially. So each of these seed chunks has to go to 11,000 clients. And that takes place exponentially. And you can see that from this illustration, right? Suppose A has some chunk, say chunk zero. So he's the only guy who has chunk zero. And one time period after, there's going to be two clients with that chunk, B and A, right? So suppose this chunk takes 8 seconds to transfer. So 8 seconds later, A and B both have a chunk. Then 8 seconds later, A and B communicate to two other peers, and then two more peers have a chunk. And then 8 seconds later, those four peers communicate with four other peers, and eight peers have a chunk. Right, so if we take a look at this, we take the ceiling log base 2 of 11,000, that's about 14 time steps. So in 14 time steps, each time step is going to take 8 seconds to distribute that 1 megabyte chunk. Every single client in the swarm is going to have a chunk to distribute. And this is pretty much the key part of the process, where you get this exponential activity. Does it make sense?
Now, is this assuming that everyone stays on after they get the full file, or is this going to be true regardless?
Yeah, this is like kind of a best case scenario, but if you think about it, right, this is only the beginning of the transfer. So at the beginning of the transfer, A only has 1 megabyte of the entire patch, and everyone else doesn't even have anything at all.
I mean, obviously, if I send the first 450 chunks to 450 hosts, and they suddenly didn't receive it and all shut down, we're not going to get anywhere. So this would be best case
scenario. So for each of those 14 time steps, A is only distributed?
We're just going to make a simplifying assumption that A is just distributing. It's not receiving anything. I mean, it would be faster if A was also like using the other side of the link. So Tom's point is A is using only the send side of this 1 megabit per second link, not the receive side. But this is just for simplification purposes. And also, of course, I left out all that like important stuff, like all that overhead to figure out who has what chunk. And we just kind of magically abstracted away for the purpose of this problem. It's just to give you an idea of why a peer-to-peer topology can be more efficient. Any other questions?
Is this a total number distribution of one chunk or distribution of one chunk?
Can you say it a little louder?
Is this the total number distribution of that one chunk across all the users?
Yeah, so this is the total time it takes to distribute one chunk to 11,000 other clients.
I mean,
no, it's 11,000 other clients, because there's going to be 450 chunks. So each of the 450 chunks times 11,000 is 5,000. So each chunk is going to get distributed to about 11,000. So since there's 450 chunks, you have the 5 million. Each of the 5 million clients has one chunk.
So the total distributing time for the entire file would be 450 times 2 minutes?
Yeah, so we're going to get to that on the next slide. Yeah. So this is only for one chunk. So these guys. So for the other 449 chunks, let's just take a look at one client. Because every guy has a chunk, you can always get a chunk from somebody. So you can use the full bandwidth of the network. So for any client, it takes 449 times 8 seconds, so 1 hour to download the rest of the chunks of the patch. This is like optimal case. You can always find another guy to download from. And there's always another person in the swarm to download from. It's like perfect scheduling, all these other assumptions. So assuming all that, one client will take one more hour to download the rest of the patch. And this is all happening in parallel, right? So after 1 hour, all the clients have the patch. So adding up, the seeding takes 1 minute. Exponential growth until everyone has a chunk takes 2 minutes. Finishing the transfer, to get the other chunks takes an hour. So 1 minute plus 2 minutes plus 1 hour is less than 5 hours, and one server less than 10,000. So it's good.
So for this step, you are assuming that they're using like the duplex nature of their link, but they're simultaneously uploading and downloading.
Right. Right. Oh yeah, so I kind of like left out the server. So actually, if you notice, the server is only active in this part, and it would be faster if you involved the server in the rest of these parts. But I was only assuming the server existed to see 450 clients, and everything else just takes place between the clients, or between the peers in the network, and not that one dedicated server. So it would be faster if you include the server, right?
Also, so if you're using seed to just say anything that the server is.
Yeah, it's just those initial transfer.
Okay.
Right. Just that initial transfer of that, like chopping up that patch and distributing to like the initial peers.
Okay.
Yeah, you can see it like other terminology.
And after the server active the rest of it, we'll speed it up by that much. We'll just speed up with one more source.
Yeah, it'd be one more source, but remember what I said, the server had 100 megabits per second connection, and these guys only have 1 megabit per second, so it would speed it up. So this is the perfect case, right? Like, this is why the bandwidth of like BitTorrent, the more people that are on there, the faster it is usually, but that's only if everyone cooperates and it's like, and there's, you know, they're actually adding upload bandwidth. So that's, this sort of gives you an idea of how, why peer-to-peer transfer can be more efficient than just client server file transfer. It's sort of like some of the like sort of the math you might see on a problem center. Yeah, so that one Ethernet port is handling, like on your computer, you only have one port, right? But it's handling sending and receiving. It's a full duplex.
So if you
look at inside an Ethernet wire, there's two wires, actually. Well, I mean, so there's actually four wires.
Eight wires.
Or is it eight?
Yeah, but you don't use four.
Oh, yeah, so there's eight wires. So two of them for send, two of them for receive, right? So, yeah. So yeah, they're just usually, that's the meaning of a full duplex connection. You can send and receive at the same time, as opposed to half duplex, where you can only send or only receive at the same time. Right, you need two wires because you're going to carry a whole duplex.
Is there another detail about how do you find, let's say I have like half a chunk, so I find who has three chunks?
Yeah, so I just skipped that over. This is just like ideal, you can just instantly find who has the other chunks. Like,
yep.
That's the type of stuff you have to like use BitTorrent. That's the type of stuff that the peer-to-peer protocol has to resolve.
Yeah, you have some sort of protocol you can imagine where sending a message to a bunch of people saying, I need chunks, 200 things to be added.
Yeah.
Negotiate to grab your response.
Yeah. So I didn't go over like that dependent protocol that you're using. But it's just a simple description. Alright, any other questions? Alright, let's quickly go over lab two. That's a finger daemon. And so one catch is the finger service is enabled locally on Myth or Pod. So in other words, you type finger, like your own username, and nothing happens because the finger service hasn't been enabled. So you have to redirect the finger request to the GUI server on Canvas using this syntax, and it will work. I posted something in the newsgroup on that, so you can take a look at that. So you need to understand writing servers, which I went over last week with that daytime server example, and these system calls fork exec, LP, exec V, exec whatnot, whichever exec you want to use. Pipe and dupe too. We'll go over those. All right, so here's a diagram from the design and implementation of 4.4 BSD. So just like, the guys who wrote BSD wrote a book about why they do what they do. So here's a diagram. So what happens in Unix when you have a parent process you can call fork that makes a copy of the process of the entire memory space. You get a new code pointer. You get a copy of the file descriptor tables, and everything is replicated pretty much, signal handlers. And the child will return from the fork with zero. The parent will return from the fork with the process ID of the child. And the parent, so the one thing that gets most people, if you just call fork and don't call wait, and you also don't install, or you don't install the signal handler that calls wait, you'll get a zombie process, as you see in this diagram. So that zombie process just plays around in your system forever. So you have to install the signal handler or explicitly call wait. Because this calling wait is what gets the exit status and cleans up, is what actually tells the OS kernel to clean up that zombie process. So if you don't call wait somewhere, then eventually your system's going to complain it ran out of space in the process table and it can't make any more processes. So then your system will drag you home because you can't do anything. Yeah.
Can we assume that the time it's going to take to execute the finger command will be negligible, so we can just use a wait instead of having to do a catch?
So you probably should just use. The thing is, right? You have a server because you have to fork to exec finger, but you also have to fork because we're using a forking server to accept multiple clients at the same time. So you probably will install a signal handler there anyway. To catch all these sick childs. So when the child exits, it sends a sick child to the parent. So you probably will have the sick child handler in there already anyway, so you won't have to call away. Then, so you already have to fork before you can call fork again on to call finger. Alright, so here's a forking daytime server. So, let's start at the bottom here. So, I have this sync child handler, and the way you can you read this, by the way? A little bigger. So
All right.
Is that agreeable or is it bigger still?
It's good.
What?
It's good.
It's good.
All right, so so I have this stick child handler, so this is just some function that gets called. And what it does is basically it waits on any process ID until it tells, as long as there's something to wait on, and then it exits. So what happens is, this is how you install the signal handler. So this is just a bunch of boilerplate code. So basically now anytime sick child gets sent from a child, it'll go into this signal handler that keeps calling wait until all the children, until there's nobody left to wait on. So there's a bunch of stuff here. You can take a look at the man page to figure out exactly what's going on here. So you can see I have a function pointer to, basically I made a struct that I'm going to pass into the OS through a system call, and the sa.sa handler, that's the signal handler for this signal action thing. The sick child handler, which is a function pointer to the sick child handler up there. There's some masking stuff. Some other boilerplate. You install the single handler and it works.
All right, and then we want to be able to handle multiple clients at one time. So there are a few ways to do this. One is we could use non-blocking sockets and use select, or you could use multiple threads.
This is probably the easiest way to do it. You probably won't do it for anything except the most like the simplest thing, which is fine for this class. So fork is kind of expensive because it has to replicate the entire process. But we're just going to use that in this case. So again, like last week, I didn't check the system calls for like errors, so you should do that. But so everything is the same except for this if fork thing. So if fork equals zero, that means we're in the child. And yeah, I picked the standard error, hey, I'm the child, with if, whatever. Child doesn't, remember when you create fork, you get a copy of the file descriptor table. So you should close the SD, which was the socket you were originally listening on, because the child doesn't need that socket.
Fork makes an exact copy of the parent.
Yeah. Right. It makes an exact copy of the parent, and they start executing at the same place, except that fork is going to return with zero in the client and a child, and it's going to return with something greater than zero in the parent. So the child, so all the local variables, everything in the memory space is copied over, plus the file descriptor, plus the signal handler. And then the child's going to execute this path, the parent's going to execute this path. So in other words, fork returns a different thing to the parent and child. That's how you know which path to take.
So as soon as client connects to the server forks off, the child process is just going to do some stuff. But then doesn't the parent process like close immediately?
Yeah. So
like where does the waiting
happen? So the parent closes the client's stuff, like the socket that you got from accept, because it doesn't need it. But there's the parent and child both have a reference to that socket, right? So you close the parent's reference to it, but you keep the child's reference to it. And the same thing with the original socket that you were listening on, the child has a reference to it, and so does the parent, and the child doesn't need it. So you close the child's reference to it.
Where does the parent
wait? It doesn't explicitly wait, because there is a signal handler installed to wait when this guy calls sick child. So when the child exits and sends sick child, whatever the parent's doing, it'll get interrupted and get sent to the signal handler, and it'll wait.
So this is, sorry to pursue this, but like if the parent and child process both have like sockets or file descriptors, right? So they're both have references to the same socket. If the parent closes that socket, and the child still wants to be doing something.
The child still has it open, so it's not closed yet.
Oh, they both need to close it before it's actually shut down?
Right.
Because it says close is the same as two or shut down.
Oh, yeah, I kind of left that in from last week.
Okay.
So yeah, everyone has to, if you have like 10 guys open, have like the same file descriptor pointing the same file or something, everyone has to close it.
Okay.
And you'll see this, if you screw up with pipes, just kind of saying like, yeah, if you screw up and you forget to like close one, like you forget to have everyone close the file, like one side of the pipe, and then it just hangs, basically. So we'll see this in the next.
Yeah.
You never need to be worried about closing a file which you don't need access to in the current process. It's always safe to
yeah, because you, because there's a rep, like, because the other, because the parent process, for example, has still has that in its description table. All right, so any other questions? All right, so, let's talk about pipes. Pipes are like one-way sockets in a way. In fact, in a lot of OS kernels, they are implemented as a socket, except a one-way socket. So a socket allows bidirectional communication. This is just unidirectional communication. So it's useful for communicating from a parent to a child, or the other way around. And a pipe is just it just bundles two file descriptors. The zeroth one can be written to, and the first one can be read from. So it's analogous to standard in and standard out, because zero is mapped to standard in, and one is mapped to standard out in Unix, and when you create a process. And so the usual usage is going to be something along the lines of create a pipe, fork, so this is assuming the parent wants to communicate with the child. The parent closes the read side of the pipe, and writes to the right side of the pipe. And the child closes the right side of the pipe and reads from the read side of the pipe. And the thing will be clearer if I just go over the example. Yeah.
So is the reason they explicitly need to close their sides of the pipe just so that when the side that's actually using it closes it, it'll be properly?
Yeah, because otherwise one side of the pipe will still be
open.
Just
stay open.
Yeah, and the thing
but it'll still
can.
Work.
I don't think it will work. They have to close it, otherwise it will end. Because like, then one process is going to have that side of the pipe open.
Well, right. No, I mean, the program won't function as you'd like it to, but like the writing, like the pipe would still work. Does that make sense?
I think so, but I haven't tried. Okay. But yeah, you should just, pipes are built in one way, so yeah, you should close one side of the pipe before you use the other, like, before you use the other side.
Okay, let's go over one more call. I'll go over an
example. So dupe 2 duplicates the descriptor. So you take the old descriptor, and then new descriptor is the target descriptor, and that'll make the new descriptor point to the old descriptor, or have a reference to the old descriptor. So, for example, if I want to send standard error to standard out in the process, like my current, any process, then I can, 2 is the file descriptor that's open, for standard error, 1 is the file descriptor open for standard out. So if I do 2 into 1, then did I do this right? I have to go look at it. I have this backwards actually. Standard out is going to be sent to standard error now. So because what's happened is maybe I should fix this well before I confuse everybody. So what I've done is made standard out, which is the target of the dupe 2 call, point to standard error. So every time I write to 1, which is standard out, I'm actually writing to standard error. That's what the meaning of the dupe call is. Any questions?
And this works for sockets?
Yeah, so that's why well, I think it works for Cygnus, but we're not going to use it for Cygnus. We're just going to use it for piping the standard out, the standard error stuff around. So just let's go over a quick example. So execute the equivalent of cat user share big words pipe to word count dash l. So is everyone familiar with this syntax at the shell, what the pipe does? So let's quickly just go over. So right, so if you type at the terminal this command, if you just type cat without the pipe, the shell starts and it runs cat with standard in hooked up to the keyboard and standard error and standard out are both hooked up to the monitor or the terminal. Now, if you put this pipe, what it does is it redirects the standard out of the first process, the left of the pipe, to the standard in of the second process, in this case, word count. So word count standard in is going to come from cat standard out. And standard error and standard in of these two guys are hooked up to the terminal, as you'd expect. And so if we use the less than operator, which is the indirection operator, that'll redirect a file into standard in. So if I added at the end of this thing less than file one, then it would read, it would send file one into standard in of cat. And if I use the greater than redirection operator, it would hook up standard out to file two. That hooks up the, in this case, file one to the standard in of cat. So it takes this pipeline and attaches a file to the standard in of it. Otherwise, by default, it comes from the keyboard.
All right, so let's take a look at this example quickly. So let's just convince you it works first. So that's running the code, the numWords code that I have, and here's So by the way, what this means is
cat dumps the entire cat just reads the entire file and jumps to the standard out. User share big words on Unix is just like a word list file, like it had like every word that it knows about in American English on my machine. And word count dash L counts the number of lines in that from standard in by default. So it's telling me, so this file has one word per line, so it's telling me I have 235,000 words in my dictionary.
So we can take a quick look at the code.
All right, so what's going on here? The pipe system call, you have to pass it in an array of two file descriptors. If you remember, we said pipe. It's just giving a name to two file descriptors. So if it's successful, it returns zero. And the zero side of the pipe, FD is zero, that's the read side of the pipe. And FD is one is the write side of the pipe. So in this case, what have I done? I've, in the child, after this fork, and in the child, in my child, I'm going to redirect my standard out, which is 1 into FD's 1, which is the right side of the pipe. So right now, I've got something like this. Right, I've got a process. I've got a parent. Called fork. I have a child. Child has standard out, standard in, all these things as usual. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take standard out and use dupe 2 to send it into the right side of the pipe. Here's your pipe. And then the child is going to replace itself with this exec call. So this takes the current image, loads in this binary cat with these arguments, slash usership, slash share, slash fix, slash orders, and it runs it until it exits. And then the parent, I'm going to first close the right side of the pipe because I don't need it. So I'm not going to use this side of the pipe since the child is already using it. And I'm gonna hook up my read side of the pipe to standard in because the parent has a standard in. Let's just draw it over here again. The parent initially just has a standard in. It's hooked up to the keyboard. Now I'm gonna use dupe 2 to make the standard in of the parent hooked up to the output side of the pipe, which is what this thing is doing. And now I'm going to replace myself with word count dash out. And then it executes these two things in pipeline, and you see the output that you saw. Does that make sense? Okay.
So what the pipe command does is it splits it into the input and output.
Well, pipe is just a command that takes an array of two file descriptors, and in the OS it allocates it such that you can write to one file descriptor and read from the other file descriptor. That's all it does. And the thing is, you can use it between processes.
Yeah. And it returns zero if everything's okay.
Yeah. Right. This is the way most system calls work. A -1. Questions? All right, I think that's about time. If you have any other questions, let me know.
If you want to question about switching or something.